Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. I have got another quick read today. And before we jump into a much more lengthy discussion and exploration of electronic cash and the case for it, I want to hit another one on the theme of BitTorrent, because John Backus actually has two, which we have read a work of his on the show before. It was episode 141, or Quick Read 141, not the 141th. Episode 41st, and 41th, and it was titled "Fat Protocols Aren't New," and it's kind of talking about Bitcoin's base layer and kind of an interesting concept. It's a conversation on peer-to-peer technologies and protocols, and the term fat protocols is fat versus thin protocols. It's talking about the concept, at least, and he links a paper in his actual article that kind of goes into what they mean by this. But essentially, it's that fat protocols are ones where the value is captured at the protocol level, as opposed to a thin protocol where the value is captured in the application. So the internet would be one where the value is captured in the application layer. So like the value of the internet is found in centralized services or like just major applications like Google, like and search indexing in general, advertising, Facebook and social media and all of these things. But that's where all the value is, whereas the protocol is very thin and doesn't do much, but it makes everything else, what's the term? Enabled, I guess, is probably the easiest term. Whereas in fat protocols, which in this example we'll use BitTorrent, where the protocol itself is what's valuable, and capturing an application layer is incredibly hard. Like there wasn't really any, as you just heard in our BitTorrent Lessons for Crypto series that we just covered as a 4-part series by Simon Morris, who worked at the BitTorrent, at BitTorrent Incorporated, the company, not the protocol, obviously. And he talked about exactly that problem, was that capturing the value was incredibly difficult. There wasn't really much money to be made on top of BitTorrent and the decentralized application, and its main value was that it broke the rules. But I definitely encourage you to go back if you have not. It's a really good basis to start from and to listen to both John Backus' Fat Protocols Aren't New and maybe even the Fat Protocols paper that he links to by, who's that? Joel Monegro, and so you can dig into that one too to learn a little bit more deeply about the difference between fat and thin protocols, and then in this one we will be hitting John Backus's new article, which I think is a really great great one to follow up with our BitTorrent series, and it is titled Minimum Viable Decentralization. And this is a relatively short read, but it's another one, just like some of his previous articles that are really good, just talking about previous peer-to-peer technologies, BitTorrent, Kazaa, like all these, mostly the torrent ecosystem, and how it applies. What can we learn from it? Because I think there's a very powerful history here. We have these protocols to go by. We couldn't see all of this stuff with TCP/IP, you know, like projecting the future out was incredibly difficult, but now we actually have standards. We have a history to fall back on, to look at and go, okay, this worked. This didn't. Why didn't this work when this was technically selling all the great pieces that, you know, were making one thing desirable versus another. Why did one lose and one succeed? We have a history to cover. So let's continue doing that. Let's continue to learn what we can from previous peer-to-peer systems and decentralized protocols with another great read from John Backus, Minimum Viable Decentralization. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump in and we will have a fun discussion afterward. If we're building a decentralized application, how much should we actually decentralize? Decentralization has an important relationship with the law. Historically, the winning strategy has been to decentralize the legally sensitive parts and then otherwise build a normal application. When it comes to decentralization, a lot of well-respected people have very different goals. I think a lot more people are unclear what their own goal actually is. Are we starting from scratch and building the new internet? If we're building a dApp, is it okay for it to be browser-based and depend on DNS? You'll get a lot of strongly worded answers to these questions, but many people will talk theoretically about censorship resistance and security without acknowledging that these goals are often fundamental trade-offs against usability. We need to think about decentralization in the context of how differences in complexity, latency, and user education shape user adoption. This isn't just a theory. This approach accurately models which decentralized protocols and applications of cryptography actually saw mainstream adoption in the past. As I covered in my post, Resistant Protocols: How Decentralization Evolves, the history of file sharing shows a pattern of people moving en masse to new music platforms based on two criteria. One, minimum viable decentralization. Is the technology clever enough that Hollywood can't just kill it immediately? And two, user experience. Like any software, users flock to the product that gives them what they want. When you couldn't centrally host MP3s, people used websites which linked to externally hosted MP3s. Napster took over because it provided a larger and more reliable library of music. Kazaa's technology was decentralized in a way that let it operate for years after Napster was shut down. And then BitTorrent won the war by outsourcing liability to search engines like the Pirate Bay. Some of these shifts are because of decentralization. Others are about user experience. I didn't mention dozens of other file sharing applications, though, including many technologies which people in the early 2000s thought were the biggest threats overall. Freenet. Anarchy? Freenet came out in 2000, while Napster was still alive. News reports talked about Freenet alongside LimeWire, a very popular file-sharing program, as a threat. Quote, "The soon-to-come Freenet will offer completely anonymous and untraceable file trading," CNN reporter on Napster. The creator of Freenet said it is designed to be totally anonymous and unstoppable, a platform for anarchy. Quote, "Anarchy means without a ruler, and that sums up the architecture of Freenet," says Clark. "It does not have any kind of centralized control. In fact, it is designed in such a way that it is impossible to control." End quote. The Info Anarchist, 2000. Freenet is an ambitious project, trying to provide better anonymity than Tor and a more distributed file storage system than IPFS. Freenet never took off during the file-sharing revolution. The main users today seem to be privacy and decentralization enthusiasts. The combination of strong anonymity and distributed file storage mean that it can be pretty slow, sometimes taking over a minute to respond to a request. The project started in 1999 and is still in development now, almost 20 years later. While the goals of the project are respectable, it also makes the fundamental trade-off between privacy, decentralization, and usability pretty clear. iMule and Anonymity Forks, The I2P network approaches anonymity with a similar approach to Tor. But I2P is a closed network, which means you can only connect to other I2P peers, and you can't use it to browse the regular internet. Unlike Tor, I2P is also designed to work with file-sharing applications like eMule and BitTorrent without slowing down transfers. During the file-sharing revolution, the RIAA tried everything it could to stop internet piracy, including suing normal users of applications like Kazaa. Suing users was part of a scare tactic campaign that intended to make the average person think twice about downloading out of fear. It didn't stop the growth of file sharing, but it did instill fear in people at the time. Given that many people were a bit scared of being sued for piracy, you might assume that users would seek out file sharing applications that protect their anonymity. Developers ran with this assumption by forking popular software like eMule and configuring the application to run on the I2P network. Plenty of I2P clients also exist for the BitTorrent ecosystem. Still, these applications didn't see much adoption, and while you can definitely download files using them, it is much slower since there are way fewer users on the I2P network. If the public was scared of the RIAA's campaign to fine the average Joe thousands of dollars per song, why didn't people dive deeper down the decentralization and privacy rabbit hole? While people were intimidated by the lawsuits, maybe deep down people realized that the actual number of people being sued was so small that the probability of being sued was tiny. It's possible a meaningful amount of people tried out I2P forks of popular file-sharing applications and weren't happy with the speeds. Realistically, a lot of internet pirates may not have known about the fear campaign nor the fact that alternative software could protect them. Regardless of why iMule and I2P BitTorrent clients didn't go mainstream, we can still learn from this piece of history. I2P was slower, and using one of these clients required a bit more willingness to learn new technology. It seems like harder to use and slower experiences don't spread unless the majority of users understand that they are at significant risk if they don't embrace more complex software. Darknet markets. Darknet markets are the purest example of real mainstream crypto anarchy. To buy drugs online, you have to, 1. Power up a Tor browser, 2. Go to a hidden .onion website, 3. Create an account, 4. Deposit Bitcoin, 5. Optionally, encrypt your home address, then sharing it with the market vendor. Tor, hidden services, Bitcoin, and strong cryptography with PGP. This is the hardcore vision that the cypherpunks were talking about. This is the hardcore vision that the cypherpunks were talking about back in the 90s. Notice I said that encrypting your home address is optional. Basically, encrypting your delivery information is best practice, since you don't want to end up on a list if a market is raided, but marketplaces don't enforce it, and a lot of users apparently don't do it. Operators of darknet markets stick to Tor hidden services, probably because they know that they would definitely be in jail quickly if they ran a drug marketplace on the normal internet, where any government could just subpoena the server host. Every market uses cryptocurrencies, because a government would quickly subpoena any centralized payment processor. Address encryption is optional, though, probably for the same reason that file-sharing users don't really care about anonymity. The possibility of your house actually being raided because you ordered a personal amount of marijuana online probably seems remote to a lot of people. So why bother with all of this complicated stuff? Dread. Darknet market subreddit Diaspora. Almost every popular darknet market has a corresponding forum on Tor, which users can use to discuss topics about usage, best practices, trustworthy vendors, etc. Up until March of 2018, though, the go-to place to discuss all of these topics was Reddit. Subreddits like r/darknetmarkets had hundreds of thousands of subscribers, plus posts and comments streaming in by the minute. After a change in U.S. law, though, Reddit shut down all of the darknet market subreddits, along with other communities, to do with prostitution, theft and legally selling guns. These communities didn't die. They just followed the law of minimum viable decentralization and moved to an identical Reddit clone hosted as a Tor hidden service called Dread. The about page for the website even talks about cloning Reddit's UI for the sake of usability. By moving to a hidden service, the operator of the website gains anonymity, and users pay a little bit in terms of latency, a smaller user base, and website stability as the creator works out the kinks. Similar to how most casual users can't be bothered to anonymize their file sharing or encrypt their delivery addresses, users wouldn't have embraced a website like Dread before Reddit's ban. The lack of a big user base is probably enough by itself, but the latency of using Tor and friction of learning something new would probably also hold back adoption. KICS. Keep it centralized, stupid. Keep it simple, stupid is a crucial design principle for any product. For the decentralized world, one form of this is keep it centralized, stupid. Obviously, something has to be decentralized, but choose wisely. Freenet, iMule, Darknet Markets, and Dread provide good examples. Anonymity only really matters to users who are seriously at risk of being identified and realize that anonymity is crucial. Operators of hidden services get this, and that is why Dread and almost all Darknet Markets are on Tor. A few use I2P, but for the most part, the difference in anonymity isn't worth the drop in users. On Darknet Markets, a lot of vendors understand that using PGP is important because they spend a lot of time worried about being raided and sent to jail. End users don't understand this as much, so PGP usage varies for casual buyers. People using file-sharing services to pirate music and movies probably aren't actually concerned about being sued by the RIAA or MPAA, so providing anonymity will just seem slow, and it might be better to just recommend a VPN. If a centralized service like Reddit is popular for something that seems like it should be decentralized or anonymized, you'll have a hard time attracting users until the law forces them to find a new home. When users are searching for a new home, every little bit of confusion makes a big difference, and if you can limit the friction to just installing Tor and dealing with a bit of latency, then you're in a good place. It is definitely possible that in 10 to 15 years, we'll have mastered decentralized technology such that usability and user education don't introduce incredible amounts of friction. Looking at the last 20 years, though, it seems like every little bit of decentralization needs to be carefully administered because the side effects are strong and can easily produce an unusable experience. If you're trying to build a decentralized product and attract users in the next few years, figure out what your minimum viable decentralization is so that you have a hope of building a minimum viable product. If you like this post, follow me on Twitter. Link. I have several other posts about P2P and blockchain, and I will be writing more. And I definitely recommend that. Definitely follow John Backus on Twitter and scour his Medium page. He's got a lot of other stuff discussed about peer-to-peer technologies and Bitcoin and blockchain. And I think he does a good job of summing up a lot of the things that we can learn from those technologies and the past. And it's interesting to see, like, this is a great example. Let's go ahead and hit our sponsor and we'll come back. I'm going to get stuck in a rant and that'll go on for 20 minutes. So we will come right back. Let's hit our sponsor. So as I was saying, this is a really good example, basically discussing how or exactly in the past that kind of the tendency for only a very small part of the ecosystem being decentralized, being the most important part, requiring like the more you try to put in the decentralized part of this protocol, rather than like the more you try to just pack into this, the less likely it's going to give you the experience or the actual usability that you want it to have. For instance, a good example is the idea that we're going to be putting videos and music and all of this stuff into the blockchain. There's absolutely no value in doing that. Like, the blockchain is a terrible distribution platform. It's so sluggish, and like Freenet probably works a whole lot faster in doing that, and it never caught on. It doesn't reach that tipping point of users because it's one of those things that's just this. It's so sluggish and slow that the users, it doesn't actually give the users what they're looking for. And it's also a really interesting way to look at the layered approach, like the Lightning Network. Because right now, the Lightning Network is actually pretty similar to something like Freenet or Tor, in that while it gives the use case, like the underlying value proposition of Bitcoin, which is the trustlessness, the fact that your keys own and control your channel, you can always unilaterally close, et cetera, it does currently, in its current state, I mean, there's still tons of work to do. Amps aren't out. Channel state backups just hit. I don't have it on my node yet because the Casa software has not been integrated with the new LND. Actually, has it even been? I think it was merged. I think it was. Again, there's a lot to be done on the Lightning Network still. But it's a really interesting way to look at it. And also the concept of the fat versus thin protocols is a really interesting way to look at it. And just kind of going through this after I kind of got a refresh on the whole fat protocols idea, I'm thinking more and more that Bitcoin is absolutely the fat protocol. All the value is captured at the Bitcoin layer. The token itself, the Bitcoin, is where the value accumulates in the network. And in that same way, it is, you know, it savers in the currency who are benefited, who are, any user really, but mostly like the idea of savers because it's a store of value. It's a long-term a bet on open transparency and a shelling point in consensus around monetary policy. And with that, developers do not, like, wallet software developers and the actual Bitcoin developers, they aren't making a lot of money. You know, like, this is, I mean, if they are holding a lot of Bitcoin and they've been in the Bitcoin space for a long time, of course they've made money, but it's not because of their development. It's because the protocol has expanded out, the ecosystem has grown, but all that value is caught at the protocol layer. Lightning, on the other hand, I think of as a thin protocol, one where all of the applications, the first people to solve the usability problem, a great example, which we're already seeing, I think we're not too terribly far from that point, because the actual complexity of implementing Lightning Network, like learning how channels work and all that stuff, is not going to be something. It's going to take a long time before software gets to the point where it's doing all of these tricks for you. But I think the value is going to be caught in the application layer. I think Lightning Network is going to be a very thin protocol in that way. And so in that sense, I think it was just today I saw this. BitRefill is now launching a what was it called? Thor Turbo. Thor Turbo. That's what it was called. Thor is their service to pay a small fee to have them open up a channel with a certain amount of liquidity to your node for, you know, routing purposes and to accept to be able to accept payments from other people on the Lightning Network if you do not have any liquidity yourself, or you don't want to. You prefer doing that with an additional channel as opposed to spending Bitcoin over Lightning or using a atomic swap to do Lightning to an on-chain payment, which those options exist, but it's a big trade-off of, you know, what's more expensive, what's simpler, do you want to do it on your own, do you want to have additional channels and kind of expand your reach on the Lightning Network, so on and so forth. But the Thor Turbo is basically opening up a channel and that you are opening with them and you're putting a liquidity into it, but you're basically borrowing one of their own channels, as far as I've read right now. Again, I just read this today. Borrowing one of their channels immediately. So the second you send the payment, you don't wait for confirmations. You don't have to worry about how long it takes for the channel to open. In the meantime, you're essentially borrowing space on their channels to immediately have access to Lightning. And that's exactly the kind of user experience that those shortcuts to, so that the user doesn't actually know that there's a wait time behind the scenes. And I think that's something that Neutrino is going to slowly bring to the idea of running a full node, because anybody who is trying to get the sovereignty of running a full node, if we're talking about usability for millions of users here, they don't need to see that there is a sync time. They can, you know, you can have a little syncing bar at the bottom, but when they open the wallet, it needs to start working immediately. And I think something like Neutrino is a great example of that, because you can download all the filters for the blocks of the network for, like, you know, 100 megabytes or something like that. I can't exactly remember the complete data cost there, but it's obviously a tiny, tiny fraction of the actually downloading the full blockchain. And in the meantime, you can still download the full blockchain. Your wallet or your node should still do that to give you the additional privacy and then the security of your own, like, sovereign validation. But in that context, I think the Lightning Network is a great example of a thin protocol, and I think it's going to run out. I think we can kind of see its future in the comparison to TCP/IP. The major money, the value to capture in the Lightning Network, I think, is in the application layer. I think the idea of running your own Lightning node will not be everyone who has a wallet. It will be everyone. It will be akin to everyone who has a website. And maybe, you know, 10 years down the road, it will be one of those things where everybody starts going, okay, this is such a used protocol now, you really have to have your own website, end of story. But with the introduction of things like Schnorr and Mast, I think we're going to be able to have Lightning channels that others are custodians of, and the user still has a key so that they have a degree of control. So it will not be custodial. It will be kind of like the CASA example, except that the service itself will be able to will be hosting the software, I guess, is probably the easiest way to explain it. But with Schnorr, and then there's another technology called Channel Factories that I've talked about on this show. It allows a multi-signature agreement to set up Lightning channels. So instead of the direct custodial relationship, as if you're just borrowing coins on the services Lightning channels, I think in the same way that we've started with Coinbase and blockchain.info and all these very centralized wallets being, you know, the dominant wallets, but now we have Green Wallet by Blockstream, and we have Casa Wallet by Casa, and when you're looking at those, you notice that those are a sort of custodial wallet in the sense that their keys are one of those keys, but they are just there as a backup, a recovery mechanism for when the user loses their own keys. And then you have a hardware wallet as a third key for the additional safety. So you essentially have your multi-signature wallet. In that same way, you would have a 2 of 3 Lightning channel, which is actually what's referred to as a channel factory, as I was saying. So the channel factory is a 3 of 3 multi-sig, and you can have... with Mast, you can have that third signature that may be like your mobile signature or something. You can have that be a 2 of 3 multi-sig. So you're looking at a tiered relationship in key management. And what you could actually create in that situation is an architecture where the user has 1 of 3 keys. The second key is with the service that is hosting their Lightning wallet. And then the third key is whoever that service is opened a channel with. And what you are able to do, and with splicing and it just the degree that splicing is another, I don't want to have to explain. I'm using a whole bunch of terms that if you haven't listened to any previous episodes or you haven't dug into this stuff, all of this might seem unfamiliar to you. But this is essentially what I'm seeing as I imagine the future to be with a lot of the technologies that I'm looking at coming out right now. Splicing is a way to put new funds into a channel that already exists. But regardless, with things like that and other technologies that are very similar to that, I think there's a model there to create a non-custodial Lightning service that allows users to retain control over their channels with the 3 of 3 multi-signature contract as opposed to the 2 of 2 Lightning contract. And that also allows the really fast closing and opening of channels within that 3 of 3 channel factory. But it would always leave a way out for any single entity. So if the service like went down, even though it would explode the mempool if all the users signed in immediately to their or jumped on their wallet and were like, "Oh my God, bit refill is down." Obviously, they don't have that yet. This is just an example. Let's say at some point that is possible and is in effect, and everybody's using bit refill wallets, that all those users could still get up and actually unilaterally close all of the quote unquote channel factories or 3 of 3 Lightning channels that they have with bit refill. And that would be an explosion of traffic on the network at the time, but it would retain a possibility. And with Schnorr signatures, again, those things would only have one public key. You'd be combining your public key every time you wanted to update that commitment transaction or broadcast it to the network. So it would allow that company to compress the data of thousands and thousands of channels and thousands of public keys into very large aggregated transactions without actually having to give up, like with still giving key control to the user. And maybe there are, it's hard to say what those trade-offs will be and exactly how that model could actually be enforced in the sense of like the key structure, but I can't think of a reason right now that would not be possible with what I've read about channel factories, the basic workings of the Lightning Network, and you know what we're seeing with after years of the products getting realized and the technology becoming more accessible, just like multi-sig that we're seeing on Bitcoin, I think we could see a similar build-out to less custodial Lightning wallets in 5-6 years or so of the Lightning Network. But I think the first applications of the Lightning Network are going to be centralized companies that make it really, really accessible, that make it really easy to use. Tippin.me is a great example. You literally just log in with your Twitter account, totally custodial. So if you're not running your own server and withdrawing Lightning payments to yourself, then those keys are held with Tippin.me and controlled by your Twitter account, your Twitter password. So it's definitely not it's not the best case scenario right now, but I think that is where the first stages of the Lightning Network will be. And I think this was a really good explanation of kind of how you don't need to decentralize everything. And in fact, trying to decentralize everything is probably a bad idea. So you use the protocol in the most viable way or the most critical way that it needs to be used, which is why Bitcoin is bloating the Bitcoin network with anything other than independent property ownership verification, which is what this network is. And what is insanely powerful about it is essentially a waste, and it's going to get priced out of the market. And it doesn't really matter what the block size is, because When you get the block size too big, well, then it's not a good independent property verifier. It just becomes a, you're just trusting some other computer to do the work for you. And then you're also trusting that, you know, your government is going to allow the network to stay in consensus, that this will not have adversaries who want to bottleneck the consensus layer, and that, you know, this thing is going to, you know, no banks are going to decide that they're going to figure out how to choke the network from being able to exchange blocks between, like, the Great Firewall of China. Like, this is about an adversarial situation. If the network cannot achieve consensus across against every adversary, the unbelievable power that comes with the control over money will absolutely kill anything that cannot be sent through space, cannot achieve consensus over the Tor network, cannot be used as this is like pirate radio. If it can't be sent out and secured in the face of opposition, then it won't be. It just won't be. And I think only the fact that, like, I think the only reason, like, a lot of alternatives to Bitcoin, like Ethereum and BSV or anything that, like, would get to the point where it's actually significant, where it's actually, it makes a difference in the power that the financial system and the central banks have, the only reason that they aren't being attacked, or the biggest defense against those other networks being attacked, is the fact that Bitcoin is still there and that they might not be able to destroy it. It's like one of those things where cash, we're talking about in the cashless society that we're going to be getting into more deeply in coming episodes, is cash is a lower bound on financial dystopia. Is like the fact that cash exists is why banks are not implementing negative interest rates yet. And it's not that they tried, that they're implementing negative interest rates and people are using cash. It's that because they know cash exists, they know that they wouldn't be able to pull off negative interest rates. So I think we have that kind of exact same scenario of a lot of altcoins are actually kind of safe, and the entire ecosystem is has a degree of security because Bitcoin is there. And Bitcoin is the one that can't be choked out with a countrywide firewall. Bitcoin is the one that will hop across every border, that will make it, that will be small enough and thin enough to sneak through Tor. It will be the blockade runner that will get through every blockade that a central bank or government attempts to implement. So I don't think there will be an outright massive attack on Bitcoin unless those institutions, like a direct network attack is what I'm meaning, like a let's fork the network, let's break it down, let's ruin consensus at the protocol level. I don't think that sort of attack will actually happen unless central banks and or the governments that are threatened by it actually think they can destroy it. I think if they guess that there's 50% success, they're going to go a completely different route. And I think that's actually a barrier protecting the entire ecosystem, not just Bitcoin. But I want to talk more about keep it centralized, stupid, and the whole philosophy, the whole kind of concept that he's talking about here is that overly decentralizing things and having a bad user experience is going to destroy the adoption of could destroy the adoption of, or prevent the adoption, is a better word, prevent the adoption of certain protocols and certain technologies in this space. Because I think that's a really important lesson to learn. And, you know, there's a lot to talk about with Lightning, the Lightning and Bitcoin stack in that regard, because that's one of the major, you know, that's one of the major FUD pieces about, like, Bitcoin and Lightning Network is, you know, because it's got high fees or because Lightning is so complicated to use, is that going to prevent, is that an example of what we're talking about here? And will that prevent Lightning Network from working? Or will that mean that the application layer is where Lightning will be and explosive technology. And I think there's a lot to unpack there. And it's not straightforward. I could easily see, it's not hard to come up with arguments for why lightning wouldn't work, but I still think it will. I think it will in a major way. And I think I'm going to have an episode dedicated entirely to this, topic. And hopefully everybody who listens to it will listen to this one. Maybe I'll throw this back in there so that they can come back and kind of get a foundation of where I'm working from for my argument. And we will go through that. I think I mentioned on the episode a couple times, but I'm going to have a dedicated episode on lightning. And I think we might get the guys from Lightning Hood back on the show and talk to them about the experiences, because lightning has actually changed a lot in the last just really 2 months, 3 months. Like there's been quite a bit of development, and the longer you use it, you begin to see more and more of what works, and where work is needed and all that kind of stuff. So it'll be fun to recap a lot of that and dig back into it with a few dedicated episodes on the state of the Lightning Network and apply these new rules that we've learned from the history of BitTorrent and peer-to-peer protocols to exactly what is happening on the Lightning Network and what its future could look like. So do not miss that episode or those episodes, and do not miss our dig into the cashless economy and the case for electronic cash that we will be doing next week. And also, Stefan Lavera has posted, we're going to be hitting a couple of economics pieces that I think are really, really good. Guido Georg Holzman. I have no idea how to say his name properly, but absolutely brilliant. Wrote The Ethics of Money Production. Just an amazing, amazing book that you can find for free on Mises.org if you want to dig into it. There's an excerpt. I'm not even sure if it's from his book. It's 26 pages, but it's a really good long read that I will be hitting soon. I don't know if I'll do it as episodes or if I'll just release it as its own full long read episode. It will be out sometime soon, and I'll be hitting quite a bit of discussion about the economics and Austrian theory behind it, because the piece is just brilliant. And he also recommended actually another one by Hans Hermann Hoppe, who, if you follow Austrian econ at all, you know, like, he's one of the most brilliant writers along with Holzman. And he's got a great piece on what was it titled? Oh, Why Governments Demand Control of Money. And it's a really good piece. I didn't read the whole thing, but I've read enough of Hoppe that I'm like, okay, somebody suggests reading that on the show because they want to hear it, and I'm like, duh, okay. Yeah, easy episode. And also the one by Holzman, if you want to dig into that one early, is Why Does Fiat Exist? The Devolution of the Devolution of Money or something. All right, got it around here somewhere. How is fiat money possible? Or The Devolution of Money and Credit. There you go. All right, so we will be hitting those soon. Do not forget to follow. Do not forget to like and share this. The little bit of income that comes in from this is from the one ad that I put on the show here. So the best way to support this show is just share it out. Subscribe on iTunes and share it with somebody else you know in Bitcoin who wants to understand these topics and dig into this stuff like really strongly. And loves this stuff as much as we do. And in addition, don't forget to, after you share this out, do not forget to drop some massive applause and explore some of the stuff that John Backus has written. Because obviously we don't have time to cover everything that he does on the show. I'm hoping, he gave me permission to do Resistant Protocols, How Decentralization Evolves, on the show, but I don't know exactly when I'll get to it. It's in my list, but my list gets a lot longer, faster than I actually have the time to read. So it may or may not be hit, but it's a longer read, but it's really good. So I encourage you to dig into that one too, because I'll actually be using, I'll try to sum up in the lightning episode, but I'll be using a couple of topics or concepts from there as well for laying out my argument of the lightning and Bitcoin stack. So definitely go check that out and drop some applause on this article. A quick breakdown of some really important things to learn from BitTorrent and peer-to-peer technologies past, which, as we've talked about in recent episodes, I just think is one of the best examples for what to do and what not to do that we could follow. Let me know and drop some applause. Like, what do you think about this? Like, what's your take on Lightning and Bitcoin in context of, are they decentralizing too much? Are we trying to do too many things, or do you think this is the route to go, et cetera, et cetera? Check it out all on cryptoeconomy.life, or throw me up some comments on Twitter at @thecryptoeconomy. And of course, follow John Backus. I will have his link, and drop some major applause on this one on Medium. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I will catch you next week. Have a wonderful weekend, and I will be here, as always, with another episode come Monday. Until then, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.